Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You can mute. You can't pop. You can't pop that.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. Since I pretty much spend my adult life writing about my opinion, it may surprise you that I didn't used to have an opinion, just a big blank space where my opinion was supposed to be. I got in the habit of that when I was a kid because I had no friends. And I thought if I just thought better, thought the right thing, kids wouldn't be so mean to me. I had no idea what the right thing was. I just knew that I must not be thinking it. So I tried to figure out what other people would say and say that. It was exhausting, and I was very unsuccessful. And it just made the kids who already didn't like me like and respect me even less. Luckily, in my very early 20s, I realized this was not a winning strategy. And despite being terrified, I just started acting like myself, thinking, screw you if you don't like it. And once I did, everything in my life, from my work to my friendships to my relationships, were vastly improved. And my guest tonight is an expert in just this area, developing assertiveness. He is clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Patterson, and he wrote an extremely helpful book I recommended in my syndicated advice column. And his book is The Assertiveness Workbook, How to Express Your Ideas and Stand Up for Yourself at Work and in Relationships. And that's exactly what we'll be laying out on tonight's show. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. So I love how you describe what assertiveness is and isn't in the beginning of your book. You say, and I'm quoting, assertiveness isn't about building a good disguise. It's about developing the courage to take the disguise off. So talk to us about what you mean by that.
Well, I think people often think that what they want to be able to do when they're talking with other people is to create a really great persona, like a really nice thick shell that, you know, nobody can crack through or indeed nobody can see through. That actually doesn't work that well, and as you discovered earlier in life, apparently, it doesn't actually lead to a feeling of being liked. And it's not actually even all that effective. Much more effective if people sense that they're actually in the room with a human being. And so this is about taking the disguise off. The disguise is about, oh my gosh, what if people disagree with me? Or the possibility of a threat. And this is about realizing that there may not be much of a threat.
And like you say, assertiveness is about being there. And that's so different from what I was doing as a kid. I was trying to really be somebody else, and I really just wanted to disappear.
Yeah, there's a branch of therapy called object relations, and they talk about being a mirror object, that your function in life is to be a mirror of what somebody else wants, thinks, or plans to do. Much as we're all, you know, wonderful narcissists, eventually, even the worst of us kind of gets bored with a mirror.
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, talk about first, what's at the root of a lack of assertiveness?
Well, it kind of depends which direction a person is going, I think. If you're sliding off to one side, then you might be adopting more of a passive style. And there, really, your guiding principle, you know, your motto is avoid conflict. Do whatever it takes, because conflict is really scary and awful, and you're going to lose every single time. So you just, you know, cave in, give them what they want, hand over your lunch, and, anything to pacify others.
And
then there's
we'll get to all these styles because they're very important. You describe them as four primary communication styles that we have: assertive, passive, aggressive, and passive aggressive. And this passive one, I love this. You say that when we're communicating in a passive way, you know, that we get into these unreasonable demands from others, you know, and it's just, I mean, it's basically like we're on a leash to just anybody we know who's a little more forceful than we are.
Absolutely. And often there's this feeling, you know, like that eventually if I say yes, okay, here, okay, I'll drive you there, that there's a like a finite number of things that they're going to ask. And if we just give in and give in and give in, eventually we're going to get to the bottom of the list, and then finally it's going to be our turn. Except the act of doing that makes them make the list longer. It actually perpetuates the very problem that we're trying to solve.
Yeah, it's so incredible how we have these sort of covert contracts the way it's going to be, except other people have no idea, and they just they see that we're marks and they can play us.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't sign anything. They don't realize that the hidden contract is I'm going to do all this great stuff for you and pacify you, and in return you're going to love me and respect me, and they don't because they didn't realize that was the bargain.
And you know that it's beliefs that hold you back, that we always have the choice of whether or not to be passive. So what are some of these beliefs that hold us back if we're a passive communicator?
Well, one of them is just that conflict is too scary, that you don't have the resources, you don't have the ability to fight back against these things. So if they disagree with you, they're going to attack you, and you're just going to cave in anyway, so why not just do it, like, right off the bat? Another one is the sense that if you've been doing this for a long while, you're so resentful by now that if you open your mouth, it's like a balloon popping, right? It's all going to come out all at once, and you're going to go into an insane rage that's going to last for weeks. That's slightly less common. But a lot of people are raised with this idea, you know, you're only worthwhile as long as you're doing something for someone else. Now, great, do stuff for other people and get a lot of self-esteem out of it. Fine, this is actually successful child raising. But only is a problem. So people really feel that that is their value, is subsuming their own identity and interests in favor of others.
And you
so those are a couple of things.
And you say also that people that grow up in these families, either where the family is so violent and aggressive that anything but passivity is sometimes a bad style just for staying alive, and that some people just don't see assertiveness in action. And so, you know, they sort of don't have any good examples of people close to them. I mean, of course they have them in the world, but it somehow keeps people back to come from that kind of background, tends to.
Yeah. Even in the world, I mean, you don't really see people in their bedroom, in their intimate relationships. And so that's the model that you often have from your childhood. So if you don't see it, then you might not know, well, how would I do it then? You know,
right,
it's very hard to make this stuff up.
And you brought up a great point. It just pervades your life. So even in the bedroom, something as simple as saying, slower, faster, can we do that longer? I mean, people, they're so meek, the passive people, that they don't have the sex lives they want, so no wonder they're angry, because they never get what they want.
Yeah, yeah. And that's often where our anger comes from, is the sense that we didn't get what we wanted, even though we actually never asked for it.
Yeah.
People didn't read our minds properly.
Right, because we're not asking for it. Well, let's move on to the aggressive style. I think we all understand what that is. And you point out that it's a style that has some advantages for achieving your goals in the short run, sort of intimidating others into doing what you want.
Yeah, I mean, if you emote loudly enough, you'll scare people into doing what you want, whether you're a boss, a partner, a parent. But, you know, it does have those disadvantages. You know, it's going to scare them off, and eventually they're going to try and avoid you. They're not really going to want to be there, and they don't really want to cooperate with you.
Right. And you say that, you know, this feeling of power and justification for what you're going for, it fades quickly. I mean, that can't feel good to be aggressive all the time. That's pretty stressful to have that always be your style.
Well, it's stressful during it. I mean, the fight or flight response, fight being, you know, anger, in effect, or the emotional component of it is anger. Afterwards, people wind up with a sense of guilt, a sense of, oh, I really probably shouldn't have said that. Maybe I'm overdoing it. Or even, for example, if you're an employer, you realize you've got this huge turnover rate and you're constantly interviewing new employees who are only going to last a week. So there's all these downsides, emotional and practical, to that style.
And then you talk about the passive-aggressive style with elements from both the passive and aggressive styles. And you give an example. One of them would be undermining coworkers by bad-mouthing them to the boss, or accidentally, quote-unquote, dropping a can of paint all over the bathroom floor, or, doing a household chore so badly that someone else takes over. These things, people who do these, what's behind this kind of behavior?
Well, I would say that, when I was writing the book, I think, do I really want to put this in? And then I realized I did, because it's distinct enough. But really, what is the passive-aggressive style? It's aggression with deniability. And that's the key, that you want to actually get your own way or put the knife into the other person, but you want to do it in such a way that you don't have to take responsibility for that at all. And if they call you on it, you can just say, well, what? It was an accident. I forgot, or the bus was late, or what have you.
Right, and this was an important thing you brought up, because this, you have a plausible excuse and passive aggressiveness that allows you to avoid taking responsibility. And you said, sometimes you really are late, or you really do have a headache. And so you can get away with that pretty well, but it's pretty ugly and not healthy. Like the assertive style, which basically you say recognizes that you're in charge of your own behavior and you're going to decide what you will and won't do and communicate it.
Yeah. That's the core of the assertive style. As a matter of fact, when I was writing the book, I was thinking, is there one core idea? And occasionally people would interview me, and I thought, they'd want something in 5 minutes. I thought, what can I possibly say in 5 minutes? I have no idea. And then I realized that there actually is a theme to the book. And I was even flipping through it today and realizing, it's not in here. It's not in here. I don't think I actually say it at any point in the book. At some point, there will be a revision.
Say it now.
I will say it now, Amy. It is, assertiveness is not about controlling other people. It's about controlling yourself. That's it. In effect, assertiveness is about giving up on controlling other people. In the passive style, I'm trying to control them by pacifying them. In the aggressive style, I'm trying to control them directly by making them do what I want and scaring the pants off of them. The assertiveness style is about giving up on all of that and controlling what you can actually control, you. And that's pretty much it.
It's so important. And actually, you get into this time and time again here. You say, and I'm quoting you, a hidden and often poorly understood aspect of assertive behavior is the idea of relinquishing control over others. And that's a really rational thing to realize, too. You can't make anyone do anything, as your mother probably said to you, to all of us, not your mother, but, can't make somebody do something. And you really can't. You can persuade them, and a better way to persuade them is in a clean way, using assertive language rather than passive-aggressive or scaring them, with aggressive language. So I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being clear and using clear communication. Communication is the most difficult, complicated thing imaginable. I mean, people always say that the human brain is the most complicated thing in the universe. Well, of course, we haven't traveled everywhere, so how do we know? But it's one of them. And in communication, we've got two of them with completely different histories trying to get across ideas from one to the other through imperfect language. It's unbelievably difficult, so it takes a lot of practice.
This was actually an important point you made, and we'll get to it, about people needing to use clear language when they're asking for something, not to be all mealy-mouthed. I mean, that's, I guess, not assertiveness anyway, but that it's really important to put things into the proper words. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Patterson. He's author of a book I recommend in my column. It's terrific, and it is The Assertiveness Workbook, How to Express Your Ideas and Stand Up for Yourself at Work and in Relationships. And I love this because it's really practical, and you over and over again let people know how they're going to fail and what they should do to remedy that, which I think is very realistic and great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people are going to have that temptation. You could try. I mean, if you're trying out anything in the book, and you need to, then it's probably because it's an unfamiliar thing. And of course, the first thing that happens anytime we try anything unfamiliar is we think, maybe I don't really want to do this. Really, you know, it feels too awkward. It feels wrong, and I don't think it's going to work anyway.
Well, another thing that you talk about that's a big problem is the stress barrier, as you call it. And people, you say, may be convinced that the assertive style works better and still not use it because using it takes overcoming some things, including especially the stress response, our fight or flight reaction that comes now, not when we're faced with a hungry tiger, but with some kind of, oh, my God, I have to actually ask somebody straight up to do something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the fight or flight response really leads us either flight, fear, running away, maybe from conflict, leads us towards the passive response. And the fight response, pretty obviously, leads us towards the aggressive response. So although we sometimes think of passive and aggressive as sort of opposite directions, in fact, the stress response leads us to both of them. Actually, they're quite similar. And the assertive response typically takes creativity, calming down, thinking about your options, trying to come up with what might actually work in terms of what it is that you really want and how to word it clearly. And that's exactly what the stress response interferes with.
And you talk about bodily ways to deal with that, with like breathing. And then also, I love this, you say, deal with stress by reevaluating your appraisal. You know, are you making too much of the situation? And I think that's a really important thing to do, to stand back and evaluate like that.
Yeah. I mean, the stress response is designed basically to help you survive, physically survive, the next 5 minutes. I mean, it evolved in a period when saber-toothed tigers were running around. That's a gross oversimplification, but nevertheless. And so it's about trying to make us faster and stronger so we can survive. And often, if you actually look at what you're stressed out about, it's that you've got a dinner party and you haven't figured out what you're serving for dessert yet. You're freaking out. You realize, you know, if I never figure this out, they're probably not going to shoot me. My life is actually not in danger. I can relax.
Yeah, if there's no dessert, even if you, Julia Child, she'd say, if you muff something up at dinner, just go on. You know, but your guests, they're not there. If they're there for the food, you're a better cook than you probably are. And so I think people need to relax about these things and realize, if you look at them, say, from the perspective of, well, what if I had a car crash? Then suddenly, oh, you don't have dessert. Oh, who cares?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the frame that we use often has a tendency to narrow and narrow and narrow, so that we begin getting stressed out about, you know, do I have the proper glasses? Did I wear the right thing to the party? Who cares, ultimately?
Yeah, and you talk about how where our interpretations of events come from. One is perception of the event itself, and then the other is a system of beliefs about ourselves and other people, about the world and how the world works. And so if you can recognize what your system of belief is, then that can help you realize, oh, well, that's where that's coming from, and maybe help you see that you are being a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious thing to me when I'm appraising something is, well, why do you think that? Well, look at it, you know, it's the situation I'm in. I'm interpreting it the obvious way anybody would. But really what I'm doing is I'm interpreting it based on what just happened, but also on my entire life history, which has built in all these assumptions, you know, like this kind of person is really difficult to deal with, or these kinds of situations never work, or, you know, what have you.
Well, I love the thing you say. You say that the way to change our unhelpful belief systems is to be aware of our distortions of events that you experience.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't identify what it is that you're thinking about the situation, you certainly can't change the way that you're thinking, and it's very difficult to get distance on it. So it's always worthwhile to ask ourselves, what's holding me back here? Let's say I'm reluctant to express my opinion about something. What's holding me back here? What do I think would actually happen if I did this? You know, if I was open.
That's a great question. What would actually happen? Is the earth going to open up? You're going to fall in. Something will grab you with a big claw. Or, you know, will you just be embarrassed for 30 seconds and life will go on?
Yeah. I think that people really need to seek out embarrassment as much as possible. Because you need to convince yourself, as a matter of fact, you need to convince your gut that you can survive embarrassment. The only way, you know, you can't read a book and figure that out. You just have to do it. So, you know, the clumsier you are, the better, really. You know, you just need to fall on your face a whole lot.
Yeah, that is such great advice. And we talked a little bit about Albert Ellis, the late founder with Aaron Beck of cognitive therapy. And he used to have people in New York, and I think I've talked about this on the show, go to the Rockefeller Center and say, I just got out of a mental institution. Do you know what month it is? And call out the stops in the subway. So they would see that those horrible things didn't happen, that nothing really happened. People thought, oh, another New York weirdo, whatever.
A friend of mine went through a course of therapy, and her graduation exercise was to set up a card table with a tablecloth and nice silverware and serve herself a wonderful meal at the corner of Georgia and Granville Streets, which, let me think, would be basically the New York equivalent of Times Square. Alone, right? So she was supposed to do this, and she actually had to eat the entire meal very slowly. And she said, you know, after that, I haven't really worried about things too much because people thought I was really crazy then, and I lived.
Wow, that's actually, I would love to do that. You're speaking to a woman who started out giving advice by giving free advice in the street corner with two other women with a magazine rack as a table on West Broadway and Broome in Soho as a joke, and people sat down because the sign said free. So obviously, I'm hard to embarrass these days. So.
Well, I mean, and that's wonderful, right? I mean, that kind of fearlessness, I think, is cultivated in the same way that we cultivate muscles, with practice and reps.
You're absolutely right. And you remind me, so here's something that people could do, and probably nobody wants to do this but me, but I actually want to, because I like to make people laugh, go out. I want to get ears, little cat ears that match my hair, and just wear them unremarked to go to the drugstore. But those things really, when you see, actually you'll make people laugh, and in a good way, usually. And even if you don't, you'll see that it isn't fatal, and it's kind of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I invite clients that are fearful of embarrassing themselves. I say, you know, you're really not afraid of other people. You're afraid of embarrassing yourself. So unfortunately, we have to do it. And can you think of anything that would be conceivable? And we have people, you know, trip on curbs and things like that, or indeed fall down if they're any good at that, right? Or have your hands shake so you spill a little coffee at the coffee shop. Something like that. You know, they can be very, very small, but the very fact that you did it deliberately, you deliberately did something stupid, you made something wrong, you parted your hair the wrong way on purpose, really is startlingly powerful. You might think you need to do, like, something way over the top. You don't.
I tend to think if you have problems with a part level of life that you have really deep problems, but I do think that if you can look at your life and laugh at it, and there's an important thing, and we just talked about Ellis for a second, but he talks about how people are, that we need to accept that we're fallible, and once I accepted that we're all screw-ups and that I'm fallible and I make mistakes, then I could laugh at my mistakes instead of finding them evidence that I am a horrible, bad loser of a person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people, you know, are often fearful of becoming assertive because they're afraid that they might not do it right. And I always tell them, well, you won't. I mean, that's not a possibility. That's a certainty, you know, for a long while. We just have to get through that awkward stage where we are practicing it, and it doesn't come out all that smoothly. We just need to lighten up a little bit and realize that it's probably not the end of the world.
No, we really do. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how to become assertive. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Patterson. He's author of a book I really recommend, The Assertiveness Workbook, How to Express Your Ideas and Stand Up for Yourself at Work and in Relationships. So you say something very important. You say we communicate with people on two levels, the verbal and the nonverbal channel, and that you can be saying something where you're stating your opinion assertively, what you want, and that you can be very milquetoast in your posture and voice, and it just that sort of wins the day rather than your wonderful assertive statement.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that the nonverbal stance actually says less about the information you're giving, but it says more about what your actual stance is with regard to it. So if I express my opinion and I say, you know, Amy, I feel very, very, if you'll forgive me, very firm about this, and then I express my opinion, people, and I, you know, I could emote like that for another 10 minutes, prevaricating, but nevertheless, you would eventually think, yeah, well, he just expressed his opinion, and at least I know what it is, but I don't actually believe that he has it, you know, firmly in hand.
And you talk about the physical areas people should consider when they're thinking about how they communicate. And this is really important. I love how you break them down. You talk about the face plane, the body plane, and their personal space. So tell us about the face plane and how people can go wrong with that.
Well, the face plane, the idea is, imagine that you have like an index card, a recipe card, something like that, and you stick it right on the end of your nose. So that if your head is up and down, it's entirely vertical. That is a vertical faceplate. If we're being a bit snobbish, you know, with our nose in the air, then the piece of paper might be actually pointing at the ceiling. And if we're being like many people are when they're passive, we'll be sort of it'll be pointing at the floor a little bit. So what you want is a face plane that is vertical as much as possible and pretty much pointing at the person you're talking to. Typically.
And just to emphasize something, and we talked about this before the show, you and I too, that you say, don't expect to just do this perfectly. Expect to practice this and to forget, because we're all human, and that sometimes you'll get it right, and then you have other things to remember, the body plane, the personal space, but that, you know, expecting perfection is a losing game.
Yeah, imagine if you were playing darts, you know, and you think, okay, well, I'm going to learn darts. It's really important. You know, my entire business, everybody plays darts. It's the road to happiness and fulfillment. And you throw one, and it lands on the floor. Well, you'd expect that. You'd expect that. But with assertiveness, the temptation is to expect that it's going to go perfectly the first time. It probably won't. Probably won't.
No. I found that. And now talk about how your body should be. If you're, what is an assertive body position?
Well, you can think of a surface defined by your two shoulders, the front of your body, the two shoulders, and the pointy bits on your pelvis. And that those four points, what we want is for that paper not to be too twisted up. We want it to be straight, and ideally pointed vertically, or at least in a vertical plane, so that it points more or less directly at the person that you're talking to, not down at the floor, not in a kind of Uriah Heep, if you please, master posture. I think a lot of assertiveness is really about submission postures that you can actually see in dogs and things like that. You can see a submissive dog. You can see what it does. And as humans, when we are passive, we adopt that same posture. And
right.
It communicates really
right,
clearly to the person we're talking to.
Right, hanging the head. I know, because I have a puppy, and she's in the training phase. And when she knows she's somewhere, hangs her head, slumps down, eyes on the floor, you know, like if she doesn't look up, that you won't see her.
Yeah, it's so remarkable.
It really is.
And it's so similar to humans. You think, this has got to be wired in way back there somewhere.
Absolutely. And now, this is very interesting. You talk about personal space. So we have an imaginary bubble of space surrounding us that, you know, people are comfortable getting closer or not being closer, depending on the culture. And you say, you know, that how people deal with the discomfort people feel when somebody's in their space, that relates to being assertive.
Yeah, well, it partly relates to how I perceive the other person. If somebody's really too close to me, I'll see them as really pushy and, you know, trying to be a little bit aggressive with me or to get their own way and so on. And that may not be at all what they're planning on doing or what they're trying to do. Similarly, if somebody is too far away and and if that body plane we talked about earlier is sort of oriented away from me, then I might think, well, they're kind of avoidant and they're expressing this message, but it's not very powerful. I could probably ignore it and get by. It's challenging sometimes to figure out because there are such wide cultural differences.
Right, and it's very important. People don't really realize, and I love this chapter you have on nonverbal behavior because that really is the other half, or sometimes more, as you say. And there's more recent research on something called power poses. I've talked about on the show before. Dana Kearney and a few other researchers have done this research that seems to show that if you pose in those sort of quintessential Gordon Gekko, hands behind your head, feet up on the desk poses, that it measurably increases your testosterone, your willingness to take risks, and the sort of gambling games economists give people in these studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, your advice for people to practice this healthily assertive body language is really important because that can maybe sort of put the verbal stuff we'll get to next on turbo in a way.
Yeah. We might not want to adopt a really aggressive-looking posture unless we're in a situation that might call for that, in which, let's say, we're dealing with a bank manager who's deciding how to deal with us and so on. If we look very, very confident, that might work in certain circumstances. But, adopting an assertive body posture and certainly trying to work against the passive, submissive posture that we often give off is really, really useful. It not only affects what we communicate, but it also affects us. If you actually pull your shoulders back, pull your head up and back a little bit, push out your chest just a little, and walk in that way, you actually are likely to feel different.
And now that's a lot to think about, but one way people can do this is to pick somebody, and I think a movie star who's just the Cary Grant of our time is George Clooney, that if you can't think, okay, I have to keep my shoulders back and do all this stuff, you can actually just pretend you're George Clooney and go work on, you know, doing this with strangers, behaving in a confident, assertive way, as opposed to, like you were saying, we don't want to be like Gordon Gekko, who was a jerk on Wall Street in that movie a million years ago. We want to be somebody who walks confidently as opposed to swaggering like a jerk.
Yeah, and I think Clooney, in many of his roles, kind of gives that off very, very nicely, a very relaxed posture. You can imagine if this guy has a heart rate monitor on, it's not going up very high. He's relaxed, it's very loose, and it's friendly, and he has a relatively easy smile and that kind of thing. That's very much what you might want to put across, depending on the situation.
Yeah, and getting back to something you said before, it's so important to breathe. And Emily Deans, who is a psychiatrist I respect, has just posted something in Psychology Today about what she calls Darth Vader breathing, which I love that name. But it's basically what I learned to do so I can fall asleep. I learned it. I took one yoga class and hated it, but I learned to breathe. And you just breathe in and out very slowly through your nose, and it helps you regulate your breathing. Whereas when you're nervous, you're more likely to hyperventilate, you have your mouth open, then you get dry mouth, and it just all contributes. It just all builds in nervousness, and, you know, ultimately passivity tends to come out of that rather than this wonderful, healthy assertion.
Absolutely. We are breathing when we're stressed out, and when we're moving into anxiety, tends to become more shallow and more rapid. And our stomach stops working. We stop using our diaphragm. So the one tweak that I encourage people to add to that idea is to just lie there and stick a hand on your stomach. And what we're trying to do is to gain about 10 pounds every time we breathe in and then lose them again as you breathe out, thankfully. And really inflate the stomach. You know, you know that you've got two lungs and you know where they are. They're in your chest, but you've never actually seen them. For all you know, you might actually have lungs in your stomach, and just pretend that you do, and those are the ones you're breathing into.
Right, and actually it helped me to hear from a speech coach who told me this is called diaphragmatic breathing. So you're breathing into your diaphragm, which is below your lungs, so it gives you sort of a target to hit rather than just saying, okay, breathe deeply. That helped me anyway.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that I have an online breathing course on just that topic, as a matter of fact.
How can people tell us your website so people can find that?
Well, that's at a website. It's an online education website called udemy.com, and the course is called Breathing Made Easy. But it's easily accessed by going to my own website at psychologysalon.com as well.
psychologysalon.com. And can you say that again, because it sounded like you said udemy.com, and I don't think that's
I know. I don't know why they picked that name. udemy.com.
As I said, I'm immature and laugh at myself all the time, and obviously for good reason. So I want to talk about a very important part, the other part of being assertive is giving your opinion. But before we get into that, how do people get in touch with their opinion if they are people like me who just submerged it, basically drowned it like a cat in a bag in the river, like in those old stories, and then they're 22 and they decide, okay, I have to state my opinion. How do they get there?
Well, I mean, first off, you listen, and that little voice is so quiet, and it gets quieter the less we pay attention to it. If it's irrelevant, it just fades away. A friend of mine was raising children for years and years and years and years, and she said, you know, for all that time, if like what restaurant do we go to, where do we go next, what do we do next, it was all about what needs to happen, what do the kids need, and so on. And at some point later in life, she realized that if somebody said, what kind of restaurant would you like to go to, she would listen, and there was just this great resounding silence. Like she couldn't hear anything. There was no opinion at all. And so what she really needed to do was to practice listening to herself. There's a great question that you can ask yourself, and that is, what if nobody cared? You know, nobody here has the slightest, makes the slightest difference what you want, what restaurant you go to, or anything like that. Quentin Crisp had a lovely question.
Yeah.
If there, do you know him?
Oh, yeah, because I live near him in New York. I loved him.
Wonderful, wonderful. I met him at one point.
That's great.
He was lovely. But he said that the most important question in life is, if there was no applause and no criticism, who would you be? And corollary, what would you do? In other words, if you couldn't do anything to impress anybody, there was just no way of doing it, and you didn't have to worry about their criticism, then what? And that's a little knife that you can use inside your own mind to try and find, what do I want? And then by listening to it and by acting on it, you can actually begin ramping up the volume on that voice.
That's great advice. And you also give some more practice on this, give people some more things to practice with, an issues list. And people can make these up themselves. Do you believe in abortion? You know, there are things like, do you think that child labor should be justified in poor countries? What is the best place to live in your country? You know, all these things. Should we have the death penalty? Is whaling ever defensible? I'm reading this on page 104. I'm reading the paperback. And this is the Assertiveness Workbook, How to Express Your Ideas and Stand Up for Yourself at Work and in Relationships, by clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Patterson. And it's a really great, extremely practical book that even tells you how you're going to fail and how to fix that. So I think that that's really, really important. You talk about practicing, and, you know, people can do this. You know, you talk about realizing you're going to fail, and that if you're going to fail with sort of the people that in your regular life, then maybe you should go to people, sort of lesser people. Go talk to a guy on a bus stop who you don't know and give him your opinion, and you'll see that it's not fatal. It's a little easier than starting out right in there, you know, going to the sort of the most popular person in your circle and stating your opinion very boldly.
Yeah, I mean, if we're afraid of heights, what we automatically do is we create a hierarchy, you know, with going across, let's see, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, maybe being at the top, or bungee jumping or something, standing on a chair would be, you know, smaller down, and so on. So we automatically do that and then start easy and work our way up. That's exactly what we need to do with assertiveness. When people start taking an assertiveness course or even reading this book, they often think, okay, like, what? Why am I doing this? And they think, it's my spouse, it's my mother-in-law, it's my boss, it's, you know, that one person. And I always tell people, okay, that's the last person we're going to work on. we're going to start with telemarketers.
That
you know,
is so
something
smart.
Easy.
Oh, I like playing with them. I try not to because it's small with me. But you have this great advice, consider before justifying. And you say some people feel threatened when others disagree or challenge their opinions. They become angry and go to extraordinary lengths to convince the other person to come around to their own view. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, if I express my opinion, you know, I vote for this party because I think they have the interests of my country, province, state, whatever. On balance, I think this is a good idea. Fair enough. Where's the threat there? There really isn't one. But if I think that somehow I need to convince you to vote for the same party in order for me to hold my opinion or to hold my head up, then suddenly I'm in a helpless position and I need to basically beat you over the head with all the possible reasons why you should be voting for this party, why you should hold this opinion, why you should be a member of this religion, whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's so bad, and I wish more people realized what you're talking about, because so many people think you're not just somebody with a different opinion, you're a bad person if you don't vote, think the way I do, and really you're just a person with a different opinion, and if you don't want to beat puppies or something like that, well, I might think you're an idiot for your opinion, but that's okay, and you're okay thinking I'm an idiot, you know, if there's something behind that besides just sort of you don't like the person.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that.
I put it in less than clinical psychologist language, but you get what I mean. And so,
no, listen,
here's,
good clinical psychologist language is no jargon, as far as I'm concerned.
I'm with you, and we talked about Ellis, and I loved Ellis because he swore, and they once had to not print this conference, all the talks, because he swore so much. I thought that was very funny. So this is very important, because you say, assertiveness is meant to improve our relationships interpersonally, you know, our romantic, our friendship. So we might expect everybody around us to be very enthusiastic when we become more assertive. And you say, nah, don't count on that.
No. I mean, part of it is that if we are appointing ourselves doormat, to put it unkindly, that has some real downsides for the relationship. Ultimately, people don't want doormats. But it is convenient. You know, if my partner is my doormat, then I always get to go to my restaurant, and we always get to go to the movie that I want to see, and so on. When the partner begins taking that back, when the friend, when the employee, when whoever begins taking that back, it's like you are taking away control from the other person. They're only controlling their own behavior, but that's control that you've had, and you don't want to give up control. Life is difficult, and so they'll often resist that. The problem is, ultimately, assertiveness will be helpful in the relationship, almost certainly, but in the short term, they're going to resist it because of what it means, because they're losing control, and also because if you suddenly say, well, actually, you know, I'd like to go to a Greek restaurant, it's like a repudiation of your entire relationship, in which it's been the other person who decides what kind of relationship it is.
Right,
or what restaurant
I love how
you go to, sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, I love how you put this. You call it the history problem, that your friends are used to you behaving passively. And you say, you know, take time when you're becoming more assertive to think about people in your life. If you become more assertive in your relationship, who's likely to resist? Because then you'll be prepared for this.
Yeah, and you can also tell them, you know, oh, I realize I've been unassertive and I've been kind of fearful about expressing my own point of view, so I'm going to be doing that a little bit more. It might not be the most convenient thing for everybody, but oh well. But I'm going to be doing it. In this way, people will realize what you are doing. It's not that suddenly you hate them or you're becoming this completely different person or you're depressed or, you know, some pathology is overtaking you. No, you're actually trying to stand up for yourself a little bit more. The symbolic value of what you're doing is clearer.
That is great advice, to announce that to people, announce that you're working on becoming more assertive. You have some other good guidelines for people who are practicing becoming more assertive. I love this one. Only set boundaries you are willing and able to defend.
Yeah. So if you're with your teenager and you say, you know, I'm going to ground you for the next 5 years if you don't do this. The teenager knows that's not true. They know it, right? Why would you ever do this? Also, what's going to happen is the person is going to, you know, do the other thing or whatever. They're going to cross the boundary, and you're going to cave in, and essentially you're going to be a bad behaviorist because you're going to reward them for not respecting your boundary.
Right. You really telegraph to people how they can behave with you. My boyfriend's going to be mad at me, but I have this little dog, and I am just like this drill sergeant with her, but she's perfectly behaved. She's a puppy. I think she's 5 months old now, and she will do whatever I say. Sit down, lie down, stay. She'll stay while I'm making coffee for like 6 minutes, and this is a little puppy, but he'll say to her some kind of command, but he says it in a voice, and he's a big guy from Detroit and everything, but he says it in a voice like, come walk all over me, you darling thing. And she just ignores whatever he says. And so that's sort of the thing that happens with people, too.
Absolutely. It does. Yeah. You need to be able to step up to the plate, say what it is that you mean, and say it in a way that implies, actually, I do mean it. And this wall that I put up, it's not made of balsa wood.
Yeah, and I'll just restate that because I have a quote from your book. Don't back down once you've set a boundary, no matter how the other person starts pushing against it. And so just to go back to dog things again, my dog Aida, she was in her little crated area, and she started making squealing noises, and I couldn't bring her out because you don't reward a dog making noises by giving them the thing they want. So I just had to go, oh God, I have to ignore her for another 3 minutes. And then when she stopped making, I said, no noise. Then she got to come out. So she was being rewarded for being quiet instead of being noisy.
Yeah. It's often much more convenient to cave in. Like, really, you know, wouldn't it be so much easier just hand the kid the chocolate bar in the grocery store? He will fend off the temper tantrum. It'll be so much easier. Except next time you go to the grocery store, when the kid has learned, you know, if I scream, if I misbehave, I will get what I want.
And we will hate you forever, whoever broke our eardrums. And you say, here's one more. Don't become assertive with everyone in your life at once. And you said you probably won't be able to stand having all your relations becoming more difficult all at once when you're just starting this.
Yeah. One of the points about being assertive, I mean, people always respond to these things with hope. I suspect they buy my book out of hope, which some of that hope is, I should say, is probably well-placed. But some of it is not. The idea that I'm going to be assertive, and, like, why am I wanting to be assertive? So that things get better. So why would I do it if I knew things were going to get worse? And you know what? Things are going to get worse. You set any boundary with a person, most likely outcome is that they're going to push against the boundary harder than they used to. Anybody who's ever raised kids knows this. If you say, you know, I've just cleaned up that room, don't go in it, you know where those kids are going to be. So what you have to anticipate is when I set a boundary with anybody, no, don't take, you know, the best files at work, right? And we're going to do them in the order that they came in, not in the order that you prefer them. Whatever the boundary is that you set with somebody, the other person is going to push against it. And so life is going to get even more difficult than it was before. And eventually, if you hold to your boundary, and only if you hold to your boundary, things will adapt. They will get used to it, and they will begin respecting it. But you have to anticipate that things are going to get worse.
That is very, very important. And I love this. You do this very often, and I'm talking with Dr. Randy Patterson, clinical psychologist, author of The Assertiveness Workbook, How to Express Your Ideas and Stand Up for Yourself at Work and in Relationships. Your book is just so realistic. And I think that's very important. And one of the realistic things you say, which I love, is that you don't always have to be assertive all the time, and that some situations require assertiveness and others do not. Like if you're in an elderly relative's home, you give this example, you might accept a cup of tea, even if you don't really want it. And if a thief points a gun at you and says, give him all your money, you might just give it to him.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's situational, right? In general, most situations, the assertive style works better. Occasionally the passive style will work. Occasionally the aggressive style, who knows, might work. But generally speaking, the assertive style works better. I think of it as like driving. You know, you can learn to drive. That doesn't mean you have to drive a car everywhere you go. You can choose whether you're going to get in the car that day.
And that's sort of part of becoming healthily assertive, is that you don't have to use it in every situation. Maybe you do that at first. You're all excited about your new tool. But I think that's very important. And I want to move on to another thing I think is very important advice you give. You say, and you mentioned this before, good assertive communication is usually more precise than non-assertive. And you give this example, this statement, I wish you had called to let me know that you were going to be late. And you say, this assertion communicates factually what's bothering you instead of, you know, you have no consideration for me, which is an attack on a person's character.
Yeah, a lot of the messages that people give that just escalate into a kind of missile exchange of hostility is, I'm looking at a person's behavior, I'm displeased by it, but the way that I word it is I word it as about their character, not about what they did. Well, they can't change their character, and I'm mind-reading them anyway when I do that, and they're highly motivated to dispute this idea that their character is faulty. Talk about the behavior. Do not talk about the character. They can't change the character.
That's such a great way to describe that. Talk about what they did, because someone who is practicing this can write down what the person did. And they arrived late. That makes me feel this way. And all those things are not attacks. They're facts. I feel bad when you come home late. They're not going to say you don't feel bad. They can't say that. They're more likely to deal with it in a healthy way than if you do that attack on their character. You're a terrible person, and I'm sure you were, you know, whatever they were doing. So
it's always worthwhile going back over your own history, you know, and saying, okay, how many times have I attacked someone's character, and they say, and I got my way after that, and it worked out really, really well, and the relationship got so much better. Most of us have a very thin file on that.
Extremely thin. And now this relates to something else you talk about that I love. You talk about symbolic value, and you say some situations have this great symbolic value to us. You give the example, leaving the cap off the toothpaste means you think, I'm your servant. Leaving the seat up means you don't care about women. No flowers means the love is gone and the marriage is headed for the rocks. And you say the conflict often plays out around the issue at hand, the toothpaste capping off, and not the real issue, which is, do you love me?
Yeah. In marital therapy, which I don't actually do, but in marital therapy there's a saying, sort of a meme that people use, which is, whatever the fight's about, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
Whatever the text is, the text and the subtext never match in a fight. It's not about the toothpaste tube. It's not about, you know, the laundry. It's about something else. And so long as you're focused on the laundry, you're probably not actually addressing the issue.
Right.
Unless if you're actually bringing about the laundry, you know, confronting them on that.
We've talked about that on shows with evolutionary psychologists about proximate and ultimate causes. You know, what's ultimately going on here? And I think that's a good word to use, ultimate. What are you ultimately upset about? I mean, come on, you're the toothpaste cap off the toothpaste. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, this is not something people cry over. So what are you crying over? What's ultimately the problem?
Mm. Yeah. And we might be tempted to guess at what it is. But it could be almost anything. It could be that you want to be able to control me completely, which is my fantasy, perhaps. But it could also be that you just have this sense of chaos when you come home, and it just makes you anxious when you're coming home from work and you see, oh my gosh, there's stuff everywhere. Or it could mean something else. It could mean that, you know, some previous partner that you had did exactly the same thing, and that's actually what you're reacting to. It's better if we actually talk about the event.
Absolutely. So if there's a lot of noise in my neighborhood, today somehow four people are playing that loud bass that shakes the foundation of your house as well as your spine. You know, I'd go out and talk to them, and I know better than to say to them the things I really want to say, which is how are you raised and blah, 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 and you're horrible, blah, blah, blah. I don't say those things. They're not effective. But by the fourth person, I wanted to take a golf club and smash their windshield. And had they been the first, I wouldn't have felt that way because it really does build. And so I think your advice to look back to your history, you know, are you really mad at the person you're with, or are you – is this a pile? Is this a pyramid based on what went on in your other relationships?
Yeah, sometimes it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. And actually, that straw doesn't know that the other straws exist because they weren't around to see it. You know?
Right. Woman number four, she didn't know that all those other people had done this all day and that I'd been interrupted. I was writing, I'm working on something. You know, I was annoyed by that. And so I had to approach her, restrain myself, and approach her as if she was the lone person that did that, even though, I mean, really, I'm very immature. I want to just, you know, like, where's the golf club? Luckily, I don't play golf. So related to this, to the symbolic value where we're looking at something that's really not the real issue, we're addressing the non-real issue, you talk about secret goals. We often have secret goals, and I love this. We secretly want others to admit that they are villains, you write, that they intended to hurt or frustrate us, that we ourselves are completely innocent of any wrongdoing. Sometimes this is appropriate. Sometimes, you say, our own anger makes us fantasize about total victory over another person. And that is not realistic. We don't really get total victory with other human beings, usually.
Yeah, when people talk about marriage, they often talk about marriage as a sort of a long, like a military campaign, which I think is a bit of a pessimistic view. But really, you're never going to achieve total victory. I often invite people to think, okay, if you have a current partner, chances are you differ on at least one of two things, timeliness, lateness, or neatness, untidiness. And if it's been a while, I always ask people, you know, okay, so how successful have you been at making your untidy partner tidy? And people will usually say, well, not really very. And how successful have you been at making your fussily on-time anal partner more relaxed about the clock so they're not tyrannized by it quite so much? And the answer is not at all. So you kind of adapt to these things.
I'm looking at a Skype message from Greg, leave it alone, love. He didn't want me to comment on that one. But no, people just have these problems. And I think John Gottman, the marriage therapist, has written about this, that there are unsolvable problems and that you have to accept that. And I think it's very wise the way you're talking about this. You know, you have to accept that some things you're just not going to change. It's really important to not be unrealistic about this.
It really is pointless to try and even be, you know, really nicely assertive with somebody about reforming their life and becoming an on-time person or becoming a less on-time person. It's just not going to happen, so you don't do it. You know, you don't drive to an island that doesn't have a ferry that goes there. So you're not going to try that. You basically pick and choose your battles. But what you also do is you control yourself. You recognize, okay, wait a minute, I'm with this partner who is perpetually late, so I'm going to stop saying I will meet you on the corner of Main Street and Oak Street in the pouring rain. I will just never say that. I will say I will be in the coffee shop at the corner when you appear.
I'm glad I have a healthy relationship. Greg waits at Staples and looks up the sports scores on his phone, and I call him. Anyway, I'm not probably supposed to say that, but I did. So we just have about 2 minutes left. I just wanted to have you go back to something I think is so important. You have this great chapter, Postscript Being You, and I've been talking with Dr. Randy Patterson, author of the Assertiveness Workbook, terrific book. And you talk about that people who want to be more assertive have to put up with a period of awkwardness. They can't expect this to be instant. So just give us some final words on this to help people be realistically assertive.
People always want to be authentic, you know, and you want to be genuine. And for your behavior to be a full expression of who you are in that moment. When you're learning a new skill, that ain't going to happen. The very fact that we feel awkward doing it means we're trying something new. That's the feeling associated with doing something new. So as you're practicing these skills, you really have to tolerate that feeling of unnaturalness and even sometimes even a bit of fakeness, because you are faking it just the way you faked it the first few times you drove a car.
Yeah, very, very important. Thank you so much. This is a wonderful show, very helpful show. I've been talking with clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Patterson. I recommend his book, The Assertiveness Workbook, How to Express Your Ideas and Stand Up for Yourself at Work and in Relationships. Thank you so, so much, Randy.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. Pleasure.